Well, we have a big agenda tonight because I want to give you some general ideas about how to interpret the central chapters of the book of Revelation. We aren't going to be able to look at those in detail, but I wouldn't like to end this series without giving you some thought that you had some idea about how to approach those central chapters, running from chapter 8, where we left off last week, through to around chapter 19. But also I want us to pick out one particular chapter, a particularly controversial chapter, out of that section, chapter 13, and look at that in a little more detail as a kind of model, if you like, of the kind of way interpretation works in Revelation. Let's read Revelation 13, then, to set the scene, and then we'll look back to chapter 8 and try and catch the broad sweep of Revelation in those central chapters. So I'm reading from Revelation chapter 13, section entitled in the NIV, The Beast Out of the Sea. I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear, and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, "Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?" The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf, and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast, who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666. Well, now, to start us tonight, I want you to imagine that you're in the Royal Albert Hall. Let the walls recede a bit and the ceiling elevate a bit. Add a few pipes to the organ. You're standing perhaps in the front row of one of the prompts. And a great piano concerto is being performed. Beethoven's Emperor or something like that. Your program tells you that the orchestra has reached the last movement. And being a bit of a musical connoisseur yourself, as you listen, you begin to detect that the composition is moving towards its final climax. The crescendo mounts, the rhythm accelerates to allegro vivace. The dramatic intensity of the music deepens. And the score introduces more and more instruments. And you begin to recognize those sort of, that sequence of harmonies belonging to that store of musical cliches the composers have to let you know when they're getting near the end. The finale is imminent. You sense it. You're waiting breathless for the chord which you know must come to resolve those pregnant diminished sevenths back into the security of the original key. And your hands begin to rise. You're ready to accompany the closing beat with your enthusiastic applause. And then suddenly, nothing. The pianist's hands are hovering over the keys in a state of suspended animation. The conductor stands, baton uplifted in frozen ecstasy. But the last chord never comes. The last note, without which the concerto can't reach its culmination, never comes. Instead, there's just an eerie silence. It seems to go on and on and on. Now, if you can capture that scene, you'll get somewhere near the strange sense of anticlimax with which Revelation chapter 8 begins, the chapter where we left off last week. Revelation 8 begins with the words, "When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour." Now just think back over what those seven seals that are mentioned there, or the seventh one that's mentioned there, what those have all been about. We met them, you remember, in chapter 5, where we saw Jesus as the glorified and ascended Lamb of God, taking the book of destiny into his own hands and starting to break the seven seals. And as he began to break them, the last movement in the symphony of God's eternal plan for the world began to be orchestrated in the concert hall of world history. As each seal snapped open, ominous events began on earth. First, there were those famous four horsemen of the apocalypse, you remember, we were looking at last week in chapter 6. They rode out to the martial accompaniment of their imperialism and their revolution and their economic injustice and death. Then there was a choral section, you may remember. The fifth seal introduced the martyred saints under the altar, crying for vengeance. And finally, at the end of chapter 6, as the penultimate seal gave way, you remember the cosmos began to disintegrate. The stars fell, the sun was darkened, the earth shook. Everybody knew the end of the world was imminent. "The great day of wrath has come," they cried. "Who can stand?" Now, at that point, John's apocalyptic symphony seemed to have reached its triumphant finale. Six seals had been broken. He told us there were only seven. So the world is on the very threshold of the end. There remains only the seventh seal, and that surely must signify the last chord. Christ's return to set up his everlasting kingdom and to destroy every form of evil. So, with bated breath, we are anticipating the consummation of the ages, like the crowds around the Big Ben on December the 31st. We've heard the preliminary chimes, now we're waiting the stroke of midnight that heralds the dawn of a new age. And yet, amazingly, it doesn't come. First of all, John cuts to another camera and inserts chapter 7, which, as we saw last week, is an interlude describing the church in glory. And when he does cut back to his original camera again, to the previous scene, and the long-awaited seventh seal is broken, what do we read? "There was silence in heaven for about half an hour." John has taken us to the end of chapter 6, to the brink of the world's end, and now he's leaving us there in frustrated suspense. Like a damp squib on firework night. Everybody's got their fingers in their ears waiting for the bang and the thing hasn't gone off. So what are we to make of this strange silence? Well, I suppose you could argue that it's a dramatic pause. I mean, composers do have such things, don't they? A piece of syncopation in the music, even, to add dramatic effect. to enhance the reader's sense of expectancy. And if the seventh seal and the silence had been immediately followed by that final call that the sixth seal so powerfully prepared us to hear, then that would have been a very acceptable explanation. But the fact is, you see, when this half an hour silence is at last broken, it's not to introduce the final crashing bars of history at all. Instead, we're introduced to a whole new movement in the symphony. 8 verse 2. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. See, we were waiting for the last trumpet. Lo, John has given us seven of them. And once again, just like the seven seals, each of these trumpets goes on to sound in sequence, not in unison. And once again, as each one sounds, we find distressing things, but not final things, happen by way of judgments on the earth. For all the world, it's as if we're back to the beginning of chapter 6 again, with those seven seals. And the category, you see, when at last we get to the sixth trumpet, and we're all on tiptoes again, anticipating the end once more, blow me if John doesn't go and introduce another interlude to keep us waiting yet again. So the problem of this silence, you see, that we meet at the beginning of chapter 8, is really all tied up with a very fundamental question as to how we understand the structure of the book of Revelation. If you survey the book as a whole, you will find that it's built around a series of sevens. There were the seven churches, well, we've talked a bit about them. The seven seals, talked a bit about them. The seven trumpets, well, we've just been introduced to them. And if you were to go on to chapter 15, you would find seven bowls. Bowls of wrath. And in between each of these sevens, there are interlude chapters, such as the chapter 7 that we've already met. Now, how are we to understand these series of sevens? The most popular books on Revelation, by that I mean the paperback books you pick up with rather sensationalist covers in bookshops that ought to know better than to sell them sometimes. The most popular books on Revelation tend to interpret these sevens on what you might call a linear model. They see these sets of seven in strict chronological succession corresponding to distinct phases in history that follow on from one another. The book of Revelation is like a time chain stretched out. But you see, there is a problem with that model. For each sequence of seven, as we've already seen, seems to end with Christ on the point of returning to earth. The seventh seal, as we've already seen, seems to bring us to a point of cosmic dislocation, of which Jesus says at that time the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. If you look on to 11 verse 15, at the seventh trumpet, there's what we also seem to have reached the moment of Christ's return. The kingdoms of the world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. Yet both these climactic moments are followed by anticlimax. History of scenes is not at an end. Divine judgments continue to afflict the earth right up until chapter 18 of the book. Now, if we are determined, then, to follow a linear interpretation of the book of Revelation, we have to find some solution to this enigma that Jesus seems to be on the point of coming earlier than chapter 19, at the end of the book. Now, as I say, in most popular books that follow this linear scheme, the solution that's proposed, put boldly, is that Christ's return will take place in two phases. He comes back first secretly to take Christians to heaven in the so-called rapture of the church, and then, 7 years later, after the period that's called the Great Tribulation, Christ returns again, this time publicly, to establish his millennial kingdom. Now the rapture, this rapture of the Christians, is usually linked with Revelation 7, that vision we saw last week of the saints in glory. John's vision there of the saints in heaven, at the end of the seven seals, we're told, is a picture of the raptured saints taken off the earth, come out of the great tribulation. Although some, to complicate things, do hold what's called a mid-tribulation view, They locate the rapture in the middle of the Great Tribulation, and therefore located in Revelation chapter 11 at the end of the seven trumpets. But either way, there are complexities and diverse opinions within this general scheme, but either way, the scheme enables the seals, the trumpets and the bowls to be understood as a linear sequence of events, and yet still make sense of the way that they seem to anticipate the return of Christ well before the end of the book. Now, as I say, this is an extremely influential point of view, and you will find it in a great many popular books on Revelation. That's why I mention it to you. In fact, if you're really interested in reading an imaginative account of this particular kind of timetable of the end of the world, then why not read Carol Belizaire's novel, The Seven Last Years, in which she constructs the Great Tribulation as it might happen if the church was raptured in June 1988. But widespread as this scheme is, it really does suffer, in my view, from some crippling objections. First, you see, there's the bizarre suggestion that the church will disappear instantaneously 7 years before the end of the world, which leads us to imagine airliners suddenly pilotless, hospital operations suddenly surgeonless, and such like. Secondly, there's the problem that it means the entire book of Revelation, from chapter 8 onwards, is irrelevant to you or me, or indeed to any Christian, because we shall be in heaven before any of that happens. So you might ask yourself, why has God bothered to tell us? But the most profound problem, I think, that this kind of linear scheme encounters is the fact there's really no clear biblical evidence for this suggestion of a two-stage return of Christ. Now, it's true that more than one Greek word is used about Jesus' arrival. The word parousia, for instance, and the word epiphany. But it can be quite easily shown that these words are used interchangeably in the New Testament. They don't refer to different events. It's also perfectly true that the coming of Christ is sometimes likened to the coming of a thief in the night. But if you study those passages carefully, I think you will find that that metaphor refers to the unexpectedness of Christ's arrival, not to the idea that he could come and go again without anybody noticing. It's true, of course, that Paul does speak in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 about believers being caught up to meet Christ in the air. But there's nothing to indicate, again, if you look at that passage carefully, that a time lapse of several years separates that rapture from Jesus' coming in judgment, which Paul goes on immediately to talk about in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. In fact, I suggest to you that if all we had to go on was the evidence of the Gospels and the Epistles, it's hard to believe that anyone would have ever come to any conclusion other than that Christ's coming would be a single, undivided event at the end of time. That would be the obvious conclusion we would come to from reading the Gospels and the Epistles. So you see, what has happened, I'm afraid to say, is that those who want to interpret Revelation in this linear way are really forced into unnatural interpretations of Paul and the Gospels in order to create a harmony with this schema which they have deduced on their linear model from Revelation. Now, I don't like it very much. Indeed, at the risk of being pedantic, one might, for instance, ask, how can the sun and the moon and the stars be darkened at the fourth trumpet in chapter 8 if they've already turned black, red and fallen from the sky as a result of the sixth seal in chapter 6? Just as an example of the internal inconsistencies you come up with if you press that scheme. Now, the answer is no doubt that apocalyptic symbolism mustn't be interpreted too literally, which is undoubtedly true, as we were saying last week. But we might inquire if that would not also be true of apocalyptic chronology. See, there is another way to look at Revelation, which evades the problems of this linear scheme. This sees the relationship between the seals and the trumpets and the bowls in a cyclical model. These three sequences of seven all cover either part or whole of the same period of history. As an electrician would say, they're not arranged in series, but in parallel. And that is why each sequence ends with a sense of the imminence of Christ's coming. And that's why each sequence, with the exception of the last, is followed by a sense of anticlimax. John is going back in historical time over the same ground each time. The seals, the trumpets, the bowls, they recapitulate one another. And if you ask, well, why has John adopted such a cyclical structure? The answer I would suggest is because his purpose in writing the book of Revelation is not to provide us with a precise timetable of the last 7 years of world history, or indeed of any particular period of history, past, present, or future. Rather, his purpose is to communicate to us the way in which history, throughout the last days, which you remember stretch from the ascension of Jesus to the return of Jesus, the way that history throughout the last days will move through cycles of increasingly intense tribulation and disaster, followed by periods of respite. The three sevens, or the four sevens, if you like, are a literary device. They don't correspond to any particular historical development. We're not to try to identify which seal or which trumpet we're up to. They're a literary device designed to reproduce in us an emotional suspense corresponding to the mounting tension which John believes will characterize history generally. See what I'm saying? So to try to fit the seals and the trumpets and the bowls into some actual pattern of historical fulfillment is to totally misunderstand the structure of the book. That doesn't mean that John has no interest in specific fulfillment. Undoubtedly he does. But if things, as he says, do have specific fulfillments, it's because there is a sense in which history repeats itself. Just like the prophets in the Old Testament saw in the collision of the great powers of Assyria and Babylon a foreshadowing of the messianic kingdom and the end of the world. So John sees in the politics of his day and the struggles of the people of God of his day foreshadowings of the end of the world. The events that characterize the last dark moments before Christ's return will have been foreshadowed again and again, he says, through the history of the world, as the world winds itself up, as history ties itself into tighter coils, awaiting the day of Christ's coming. Now, that I suggest to you, in broad terms, is the way I would recommend that you try to understand the central chapters of the book of Revelation. Don't think of them as a linear series of events that are happening through history, either today's history or past history or future history. Think of them rather as a kind of impressionist portrait of the way history goes. Now, when we come to Revelation 13, you see, this makes a big difference. How are we to understand this extraordinary and bizarre vision of the beast from the sea and the beast from the earth? It's a case study, if you like, a model of how you interpret the book of Revelation. It's quite clear that this whole picture has to do with politics. This beast represents power. He has crowns. He exercises authority in the world. It's also clear he represents godless politics. Well, it's not all politics is godless. If we'd been reading Romans 13 rather than Revelation 13, the Apostle Paul would have told us that there is a form of government which is exercised in a way that pleases God. Indeed, God has ordained government for a good reason. He's instituted civil authority in order that his moral law might be maintained in a fallen world, we're told. Government is God's servant for the good of men. That's how it's meant to be. But of course, Paul himself anticipated that it wouldn't always be like that. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, for instance, he anticipates what he calls a rebellion that is coming, and a man of anarchy who will set himself up against God and God's people before the end comes. And that vision of the Antichrist, as the early Christians called it, is one that you find repeatedly in the New Testament and in early Christian literature. Christians expected the personification of anti-Christian tyranny in the last days. and within the terms of apocalyptic symbolism, it's this Antichrist figure that John is depicting for us quite clearly in Revelation 13. This is politics as God doesn't want it to be. Godless politics. But of course, the question everybody wants to ask is, well, who is this beast, or what is it? Who we identify it with? Now, if you follow a linear model of Revelation, well then, you have to say it corresponds to some specific political system or political figure in history. Who precisely you identify it with, or what precisely you identify it with, will depend on which period of history you think Revelation 8 to 18 spans. See, if you're a fairly liberal scholar, you might take the view that John thought that the end of the world was coming at the end of the first century, that it was imminent in his own day. He didn't really believe the world was going to go on for another 2,000 years or more. And so this beast is Caesar. Represents Roman power in his day, and nothing more than that. There's very good arguments, very good internal evidence for saying that the beast does indeed have a lot to do with the Roman Empire for John's original readers. And if you took a narrow view of Revelation and said, well, it had nothing to do with the days we're living in or the future, because John didn't believe there was ever going to be the days we live in, that would be one line you could take. Or if you took what's called the historicist view, you might say, well, the book of Revelation is a linear picture of the whole of church history. From the days of the apostles, through the church fathers, through the medieval period, through the Reformation, through the evangelical revival, through the charismatic movement and the ecumenical movement and wherever else we've got coming. And if you took that view, as traditionally quite a few Christians down through church history had done, then depending on where exactly you were in church history, you might say, well, the beast is Islam. Or perhaps more likely, you would say the beast is the papacy. Or if you took this futurist view that I've been outlining for you in the earlier part of what we were saying, that Revelation from chapter 8 onwards is all about the last 7 years of world history, then you would have to say, well, this beast represents some archetypal figure who is going to appear just before Christ's return and who is going to persecute the church most madly. In fact, if you're a real immanentist, and you like to find Chairman Mayo in the book of Daniel and all that kind of thing, then you might say the beast is world communism. After all, we are told he's coloured scarlet in a literature. Now, I don't know how you feel about all those lines of interpretation. For me, the mere subjectivism of them proves how vulnerable they are, how shaky they are. So difficult to choose, isn't it? If you've got to pick on one anti-Christian tyranny down through history that the beast equals. But if we're right in saying that John isn't intending us to read his book like that, if we're right in saying that he's giving us a picture of the cycles through which history passes, believing that history in fact recapitulates similar patterns of judgment and persecution and respite over and over again as time winds itself up towards the end. And you see, we're not forced to choose between all those identities of the beast. The beast is all of them and none of them. The beast is a symbolic figure of the kind of thing the church is going to experience again and again as history proceeds. That is, anti-Christian tyranny, incarnated in a political figure or political system. Now that's the way I suggest to you we ought to interpret this beast of Revelation 13. And I believe, actually, there is a piece of internal evidence within, actually, Revelation 13 which sort of points us in that direction, too. Just look at how the beast is described in verse 2. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but he had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. Now, this is obviously a rather strange zoological hybrid. then you have to remember what we were saying last week. John's bizarre imagery isn't to be visualized, it's to be decoded. Back in the Old Testament, Daniel was given a vision of not just one beast coming out of the sea, but four. The first, we're told, was like a lion. The second, we're told, was like a bear. The third was like a leopard. And the fourth, we're told, was a hideously powerful carnivore unlike any beast Daniel knew. Now, if you think about it, you see, it's quite clear that in Daniel 7, those four beasts represent successive world empires. We're told so, as Daniel interprets his own vision. Perhaps the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman empires, something like that. And what John has done, you see, in the case of his beast, here in Revelation 13, is to fuse those four symbolic animals together. So that this horrible beast is the general thing he sees, but the feet belong to the bear, and the mouth belongs to the lion, and he looks a bit like a leopard, we're told. He's all of Daniel's beasts, you see, fused together into one composite monster. Well, what conclusion do we draw from that? Surely the conclusion we draw is that John intends us to see in this figure the sum total of all the tyrannical world powers the world has ever known. This is a composite of all those empires that persecuted the people of God. For John and his immediate readers, no doubt this beast did represent Rome in a very powerful way. No doubt for many Christians down through the ages it did represent Islam or the papacy. Today many would identify it with communism, and the truth is he is all these, you see. He is the archetype of godless politics in every age. I want you to notice the image he bears. We're told he has 10 horns and 7 heads. Now if you look back to chapter 12, you will find that that is exactly the appearance of one whom John calls the dragon, which is identified for us in 12 verse 9 as the devil or Satan. Indeed, it is this very same dragon who in verse 1 stands on the seashore at the commencement of chapter 13, beckoning this infernal colleague of his up from the abyss. And it's that very same dragon which we read in verse 2 empowers this beast with the authority he wields. So this beast is government, all right, but not government reflecting the just rule of a sovereign God, as Romans 13 would lead us to hope. This is government in its demonic perversion. This is what government becomes when the devil gets his hands on it. This is personal evil incarnate within structures of political power. This, if you like, is earthly manifestations of those principalities and powers with which Christians must wrestle. John is providing us here with a picture there of this general phenomenon, that sometimes politics goes sour, political power gets into the hands of demonic, evil people or evil systems, and when that happens, it's a bad day for the people of God. It doesn't just happen once. It happens many times through history. Notice three characteristics by which this beast can be recognized. They're very interesting. First, invincibility. Verse 3. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. In other words, this beast seems to have an uncanny way of re-emerging when you think you've beaten him. For the Christians in the first century, perhaps this called to mind the myth that Nero had never really committed suicide, and one day he would come back 10 times worse than he was. Certainly in the experience of the church, it seemed that way, because no sooner had they lost one persecuting emperor than they had found another. Nero had scarcely been gone. Maybe this healed head for us in the 20th century is a sobering commentary on the way in which revolutions seem so often to result in worse tyrannies than the ones they were intended to overthrow. And we lose the Tsar to gain a Lenin. We lose the Kaiser to gain a Hitler. We lose colonial oppression to gain communist oppression. It's the way history seems to go, doesn't it? The beast is wounded, but always seems to be healed. He has demonic recuperative power. You certainly can't defeat him by force of arms. He always seems to come back uglier than ever. Second feature, popularity. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he'd given authority to the beast, and they also worshipped the beast and asked, who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? Perhaps it's worthwhile reflecting, with an election nearly upon us, on that great political mirage which deludes us into thinking that democracy is somehow a cast iron barrier against the abuse of power. Wish it were, sir, but it isn't. You can't fool all the people all the time, said Lincoln. I suspect he underestimated the beast. All the people worship the dragon because he'd given authority to the beast. Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him? See, people are neither as astute nor as upright as our democratic idealism would have us believe. People are quite capable of voting the beast into office, as they voted Hitler into office. See, one of the astonishing ironies of our 20th century politics is the way that our obsession with elections has legitimized the rule of tyrannical individuals and tyrannical parties who thereafter dignify themselves with titles like democratic republics and the like. Now, the fact is, people admire might. And according to John, they will gladly worship Satan and his allies in exchange for military security. Who can make war against him? Third feature, invincibility, popularity. Third and most characteristic feature of all, totalitarianism. Look again at verse 4. Men worshipped the dragon. See it again in verse 8. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast. Now I want you to notice that word, worship. Because it's that which is the real phase of this beast's identity. I mean, the other two characteristics are not infallible. Governments can be militarily powerful without being demonic. They can also be popular without being demonic. But the characteristic of the beast that gives him away is the attitude of total obedience which he demands from his citizens. He's not satisfied that men should fear God and honour the king. He wants total, unconditional submission of the will. He wants worship. I think it's possible, you know, to trace two quite distinct theories of government down through the ages. On the one hand, there's what you might call the constitutional model of government. Maybe John Locke, the great philosopher of this particular school, viewing the state as existing to serve the interests of the individual, fundamentally. Very often a constitution is written defining the rights of the individual within the state, which the state must defend and which it can never in the nature of things contradict. Such a constitutional government feels itself accountable to some higher law than itself. It can't make arbitrary decrees. It can only govern in accordance with those principles of justice enshrined in its constitution. On the other hand, is what you might call the totalitarian model of government. If you wanted one philosopher who's espoused this, I suppose Hegel would be a good choice. On this view, each citizen abdicates his individual goals for the superior good of society as a whole. The state has some almost mystical will of its own, the general will, as we've said before. As if the state were a living organism. And that will legitimately overrules the private consciences of any individual within the state. Such a government sees itself as absolute. It's above the law. Now, citizens of such a state may perform any kind of atrocity, yet be immune from moral responsibility, because they are simply following government orders, like the limbs of a body, performing unquestioningly the dictates of the brain. One of the classic examples of that, of course, is Hitler's Germany. Hans Frank says, our constitution is the will of the Fuhrer. Now, at the risk of oversimplifying things, I'm prepared to argue those two types of government, the constitutional and the totalitarian, represent in political theory what Romans 13 and Revelation 13 represent in biblical theology. Government as God intended it to be, an accountable institution subject to his law, and government as Satan perverts it, a tyrannical institution demanding the worship of men. The archetypal example of a totalitarian state in the Old Testament, of course, is Egypt, where Pharaoh was God, and the will of Pharaoh was obeyed as if it were the will of God, and God's people were enslaved as a result. Pharaoh was the first beast. The archetypal model of constitutional government in the Old Testament is Israel, with its king, who according to Deuteronomy couldn't even make any laws. He didn't have law-making power. What he could do was read the law that was there and enforce the national constitution, of which he was the custodian. According to the Bible, then, you see, political liberty isn't a matter of monarchy versus democracy, or privileged elites versus universal franchise. The way in which a political leader is chosen is really of minor importance in the Bible. The vital thing, according to biblical thought, is how political leadership is perceived by the people. The mark of the beast is that he demands to be worshipped. He represents an absolute political power, answerable to no one. In a word, he represents the deified state. And that's exactly what John is depicting for us here. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast. Of course, John could see the Roman Empire here. Julius Caesar abolished the Republican Constitution of Rome and made it into an absolute dictatorship. And the emperors that followed him increasingly arrogated to themselves divine titles and prerogatives, so that by the time we get to Domitian, we find him going even so far as to insist that men address him as Dominus et Deus, Lord and God. No wonder John speaks of a beast uttering proud words and blasphemies. But we don't have to limit the beast, you see, to that meaning in its first century context, although that was clearly and almost irrelevant to John and his original hearers. On our cyclical model, the beast represents that kind of totalitarian absolutist power whenever it appears. And the beast doesn't have to use religious language in order to give expression to this deification of political power that he represents. So long as the obedience he receives is unquestioning and unconditional, as long as his authority is regarded as absolute, acknowledging no constitutional limits, then whatever titles he calls himself by is irrelevant. He's playing God. People must worship him. The mark of the beast is that he requires that his citizens yield to him that allegiance which legitimately belongs to God alone. Now, the question we want to ask, of course, is how on earth do people fall for it? Surely this kind of tyrannical system can only be sustained by coercion of the most vicious kind. But you see, John is shrewd enough to realize that isn't so. People voluntarily submit to this beast's authority in their masses. No one who's seen the films of those adulating crowds before Hitler in the 30s can doubt John's insight here. But how's it done? Well, that's where you see this second beast comes in, the beast out of the earth. Turn your attention to him now. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. Notice that. He made the earth worship the first beast. Now, if you look on to chapter 19, verse 20, just for a minute, you'll find this second beast there is called the false prophet. And that's quite a good clue, I think, to his identity. If the beast from the sea represents the totalitarian state, then this beast from the earth represents the state religion, the false prophecy that bolsters this regime and persuades men to yield their allegiance to it. That's his role here, you see. He encourages men to worship the beast. Now, no doubt that John's contemporaries, this quite clearly meant the paraphernalia of the emperor cult, with all its impressive ceremonial and pagan hocus-pocus. This was the religion that made people worship Caesar as God. A later generation of Protestant martyrs could identify it with Catholicism, the religion that kept the papacy in its position of unparalleled political influence in the world. But perhaps today it's rather more difficult to identify. In the last couple of centuries, in the West at any rate, we've tried very hard to sever religion and politics, haven't we? It was the desire for toleration that motivated it. Peace can only be maintained, we said, if you keep religion out of politics. So they tried. In America, they excluded it by law from the Constitution. In England, sentimental attachment to tradition led us to retain the established church. But in typical British compromise, we made sure the bishops were consigned to a convenient corner of political impotence, called the House of Lords. But either way, what emerged was the so-called secular state. Politics with no religious banner to wave or undergird it. At least that's what it was supposed to be. And, of course, because we're convinced that that's what we've actually achieved, an awful lot of people want to say, well, the only place you find a beast today is on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Communism is the false prophecy that keeps the beast in power today. But are we right, do you think, to address Revelation 13 solely to our Christian brethren on the other side of the Iron Curtain? See, what has happened in the West, actually, is not that religion has been banished from politics at all, but that a new, godless religion has grown up to inform the political enterprise instead. Humanism, socialism, fascism, capitalism, systems of thought which may not use religious terminology, are which in many ways fulfill religious functions. They provide people with a worldview and a value system by which to understand themselves. These in our 20th century Western society are the ideological counterparts of Roman religion in John's day. These are the philosophies that maintain the status quo. And be sure of it, these are the false prophets by which any totalitarian of the 20th century will seek to rationalize his rule. John gives us again some interesting insights into the sorts of techniques he uses. First of all, in verse 11, a deceptive public image. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. See the implication of that? The beast always has to work hard on his PR. When you're as ugly as he is, you've got no choice. So he presents a front man. He looks harmless and respectable enough on the outside, you see, this false prophet. But what he says, if you really grasp what he's saying, is pernicious. He speaks like the devil. I suspect there are quite a number of books on the shelves of Cambridge University Library that fall into this kind of category, if we were to look for them. Second technique, propaganda campaign. Look at verse 13. He performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. And because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. An impressive display of power, in other words. In an unsophisticated age, these may be supernatural wonders conjured by magic. in an age like ours, where the supernatural is disdained in favor of modern technology, well, then no doubt the miracles of modern technology will take its place. But the purpose is always the same. To convince the general public by carefully staged advertising stunts that the beast can deliver the goods. He can solve our energy crisis. He can equip the army. He can revive the economy. Vote for the beast. So a deceptive public image, a propaganda campaign. Characteristic 3, the cult of personality. This is very interesting. Look at verse 14 again. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And he was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast so they could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. This is a fascinating feature of all totalitarian regimes. They always need a face. People can't worship a political theory. So when a political party wants to gain the total and unconditional obedience of a people, it must have a charismatic leader. In the Roman Empire, they made statues of the emperor and littered them all over the place. People couldn't go anywhere without seeing the emperor looking at them. More recently, of course, it's been wall posters, isn't it? There was the Stalin and Mussolini and Hitler that were plastered all over Europe in the 30s. In China today. And of course, most recently of all, it's television, isn't it? The modern leader must be good on the box, because now the beast image really can come alive and talk to people in their own homes. Never has false prophecy had more opportunity. The personality cult is an absolute must now. But of course, there are those who are obdurate. There are those who aren't fooled by the propaganda, who don't submit to the brainwashing of the media. For them, as John clearly implies, the old-fashioned techniques are still available, cruder, but just as effective. The reign of terror, for instance. All who refuse to worship the image, he kills. Oh yes, once failure to conform to political orthodoxy becomes a capital offence, you really know the beast is in the driving seat. Or there's the starve them into submission technique, verse 16. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. Perhaps of all the characteristics of this ideology of the beast, this is the most disconcerting to a modern audience. Because, of course, John is really describing there, in verses 16 and 17, a bureaucratic control of the economy. The beast not only holds the reins of political and military power, he monopolizes the marketplace too. You can't buy or sell without a license. So anybody who's not on his side, who's not submitted unconditionally to his rule, is in real trouble. I do wonder, you know, being a little controversial, or more controversial still, you may say, if those who in their mad rush to nationalise and centralise economic power really understand what a beast they might be producing if it were turned against the people. But equally I do wonder if capitalists with their vast corporations always going through mergers and takeovers and the like realise what a beast they might be creating if it were used against the people. And I do wonder if modern governments with their huge computers processing men and women by social security numbers, income tax numbers and the like, realise how many people today are in danger of being controlled. No one may buy or sell without the mark of the beast. Oh yes, you've got to have your licence and your union card and your identity papers. Without the permission of the political powers that be, you cannot even earn your daily bread. See what I mean when I say maybe we are not talking about something remote from our experience, something that we have to look to fascist Germany or to Marxist Russia to find. Maybe Leviathan is growing under our feet, within our famous structures of constitutional government that we're so proud of.
Maybe the beast is already beginning to turn men and women into the pawns of his economic planning or his scientific theories of management. Maybe John here for us is talking about the dehumanizing tyranny of capitalistic big business politics. Or the paternalistic tyranny of socialistic big brother politics. As long ago as the Hoover Report in 1953, people were commenting in America, whether he realizes or not, the government in one form or another accompanies the American citizen as an uninvited guest almost everywhere he goes and in almost everything he does. Frightening sort of statement to make, isn't it? And the situation is really no different in this country today. It is the cunning and subtlety of the false prophet, you see, that makes us think it's all the other people in the world who are the victims of the beast, not us. As I say, most commentators today identify the beast with communism, the Red Menace. Would that I could be so sure that the beast is coloured red in 20th century political hues. In my worst nightmares, I sometimes imagine a bright blue beast. Or even a bright yellow one. But most frightening of all, in my worst nightmares, I see him being voted into office by the moral majority. See, the ideology of totalitarianism can be very appealing to Christians, especially dogmatic evangelical Christians. Look at South Africa if you want to see how appealing it can be. Now, we mustn't jump to the conclusion that godless politics only exists in the Eastern Bloc or in the Third World. The beast may be closer to us than we think. This false ideology can convince men of his right to rule, and it's more impregnated into our minds than perhaps we dare to admit. Finally, then, what does John tell us in this passage should be the Christian's response to godless politics? These politics of the beast, whenever it occurs in world history, how should the church respond to it? Now, I mentioned earlier that one of the characteristics of the West in the last couple of centuries has been the attempt to separate religion and politics in the name of toleration, hasn't it? And most of us, I guess, have imbibed that idea of keeping religion and politics apart with our mother's milk. That's why we find it rather hard to understand the Ayatollah in Iran, or perhaps even Ian Paisley in Northern Ireland. It seems to most of us, perhaps, incomprehensibly unenlightened and reactionary to make a political issue out of our religious preferences. Why can't they just live and let live, we say? Well, without wanting to endorse either Khomeini or Paisley, I have to tell you it's not quite that simple. It may be very convenient to keep religion and politics apart in watertight compartments, and some religions might be content with such an arrangement. But I suggest to you that Christianity can't acquiesce to that. It is to our shame, actually, that in the last 200 years we have been a party to it. The reason is quite simple. The fundamental tenet of our Christian creed, our Christian faith, is that Jesus Christ is Lord. Not just my Lord, as if his dominion were restricted to the private lives of Christian believers. No, he is simply Lord, the unqualified, universal King of everything and everybody. Now, if people are ignorant of his rule, they must be told. That's evangelism. Go into all the world. All authority in heaven and earth is given to me. Go into all the world. It's because Jesus is Lord that we have the right to inform people of his kingdom. And if men reject his rule, they must face the consequences. That is judgment. Now, I suggest to you, a creed like that, Jesus Christ is Lord, has got to have political implications. In particular, it means that there is no way any Christian can ever surrender to totalitarianism. To do so is to deny to Christ that proper authority in the civil sphere which our confession of his lordship demands. There cannot be two laws, only one. And that, of course, is why the Roman Empire persecuted the Christians. The early Christians understood that. They knew you could not say Jesus Christ is Lord and Caesar is Lord. You had to choose between the two confessions. And that is why the beast always persecutes the church. At least it does so when the church is living true to its calling. If Christianity were a religion that could keep its nose out of politics, it would be safe. But it can't. Authentic Christianity is politically aware. Though everybody else surrenders their will to the totalitarian state, the Christian cannot, because he knows the rule of the beast is illegitimate. He is a usurper of the throne that rightly belongs to Christ. Now, oddly enough, I think that's probably the significance of this cryptic number 666. I promised you I'd get you have an opinion on this last week, and I'm going to keep my promise, even though time is passing. Of course, enormous quantities of ink have been spilt trying to work out what 666 means. And most of the intelligent ones that haven't tried to make a hammer and sickle out of it or something like that, most of the intelligent ones have assumed that it's an example of what's called gematria. Now, you may not know about this, but one of the interesting things about the Greek alphabet and the Hebrew alphabet is that the letters, in addition to having a letter quality, a phonetic quality, they also have a numeric quality. They are numbers, as well as consonants or vowels. And that means, you see, that if you've got somebody's name, you can add their name up and find a numerical value for it. Isn't that an exciting idea? And it was a popular pastime amongst people familiar with apocalyptic writing. For instance, there's a piece of graffiti in Pompeii that was unearthed after the volcano, which says, "I love her whose number is 545. Now that's so much more romantic than carving your initials in a tree, isn't it? And much more intriguing to work out. Well, is 666 some cryptic representation of a name? The name of Nero, perhaps. It would be nice if it were. Unfortunately, you can only make the arithmetic work if you translate Nero's titles into Hebrew and make a spelling mistake. So that's not terribly convincing. But there have been lots of other attempts to find some plausible name that 6666 equals. Well, my opinion for what it's worth is that this isn't true gematria, though it's influenced by gematria. I think this is a symbolic number, as so many numbers in Revelation are. See, according to gematria, the name of Jesus comes to 888. And an early book of apocalyptic writing, the Sibylline Oracles, actually comments on this. I don't think it would be in the least surprising if 888 were not a well-known code number for Jesus Christ within the circle of John's persecuted friends. It would be a way of referring to Jesus without letting anybody know who you were talking about. Now, if that is so, if 888 were widely known amongst his friends as a number for Jesus, then perhaps the number of the beast, 666, is a comment on that. You see, this is the Antichrist. He's not 888, he's 666. This is an arithmetic comment on the inferiority of the beast to Jesus. He's the number of a man, not of a saviour, not of a lord. This is an arithmetic way of blowing a raspberry at the beast. Well, that's my theory, and whether it's right or not, you're not going to be able to find anything better, I don't think. What I am sure about is there can be no doubting John's purpose in writing this chapter is to make us aware as Christians of the spiritual implications of the politics of our day. You must make your personal stand against the beast, he said. You can't separate religion from politics into some little sacrosanct sphere called your private life. No. You're one whose name is written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb. And that means you refuse to identify yourself publicly with the mark of the beast. You wear the seal of God's election. The two things are incompatible. See how he writes in verse 8. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast. All whose names had not been written in the book of life, belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. How is the Christian to make his protest? Well, not by taking up arms, I think that's for sure. Verse 10. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. John is telling us here that the church doesn't take up arms against the beast. She takes up the cross. She suffers. He tells us there are times when the only place a Christian can retain his integrity is either in prison or on the scaffold. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword, he will be killed. This is the kind of power the church represents, you see, the power of the cross. The beast represents coercive power. But Christ's kingdom is not coercive. His is a kingship which is nailed upon a cross, and such a kingship compels nobody, oppresses nobody. And the church that follows him carries the cross. It's by enduring the punishment that results from our civil disobedience, our refusal to give allegiance to these totalitarian, godless political systems, says John, that the church makes its stand. Notice this is not a pacifist ploy, some kind of moral blackmail, such as Gandhi advocated, or like an IRA hunger strike. Now, this suffering of the church isn't a strategy. It's a spiritual witness. And yet there can be no doubt when the church is willing to make such a stand, it makes life hard for the beast. The Roman Empire was right to treat Christianity as a treasonable offence. The Kremlin is right to be anxious about the growing number of Baptist and Pentecostal believers in Russia. Not because Christians have any alternative political programme or military muscle, but simply because their confession, Jesus Christ is Lord, exposes to public gaze the illegitimacy of the beast. When a Christian goes to prison or dies on the scaffold because he will not say anything other than Jesus is Lord and insists on imposing that condition upon every political loyalty which he's prepared to accept, he exposes to public gaze the illegitimacy of the kind of government the beast represents. And it's that...